You have a Nobel laureate in Europe, and his name is Manfred Eigen, and he's a very interesting person, and he is a materialist, and he's out to kill all this religious nonsense. He does not like Christianity. He is a materialist, but I think he's sincere, you know. I think that he's quite convinced that you can't believe in a good God in a world like we've got. And I don't think anybody's really tackled him on that question, so one shouldn't antagonize people like that. But he says this, that just as you can, by taking letters of the alphabet, A, B, C to Z, say 100 times A, 100 times B, 100 times C, right up to Z in one hand. He says, just as you can, by dicing, get out by chance A, N, D. Okay, the plus sign, the conjunction in our language. He says, because you can do that by chance, you can get a language by chance. See the argument? Now, you look at the genetic code, and if you could take the various physical parts of the genetic code out and dice them from a hat, if you could get out the word for a protein, because it's all written up in words, if you get that out, would you have formed a language? Well, Eigen says, you will. Now, let's just see if you can. It'll only take half a minute or a minute to do it. If I take, say, a hat full of dots and dashes, the Morse code, and I do my dicing, and I take the results and bind them onto my shoelace, the shoelace that I had 5 minutes ago, and I dice according to a system, and I get dot and tie a knot, dot and tie a knot, dot and tie a knot. And then I get double dot, out, tie a double knot, and tie a double knot, and double knot, and tie a double knot. And then I tie knot, 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 knot. I hold it up to you, and I say, ladies and gentlemen, by chance, I have produced the Morse code. Have I? Now, just let's try and see, because most people don't see this one. It's took me a long time to penetrate it when I was doing information theory on this subject. I show it to you, and those who know the Morse code will say, boys, he's got out SOS. So he's made a language by stochastic chance dicing. Maybe it is conceivable, that's the word of the students always, it is conceivable that that's happened. Has it? Let's try it. I go now to the Kalahari Desert in, South Africa. Let's go to a desert in South Africa. There are living bushmen who live in the Stone Age culture. And I wanted to teach them a bit of science, so I get them all around the campfire and show them my magic, by which I can produce a language out of a hat, just by chance. So I make dot, shoelace, dot, shoelace, double dot, shoelace, double dot, shoelace, double dot, shoelace, dot, dot, dot. And I hang it up to them and say, look, I've produced the Morse code. Well, you know, those boys, they look at me, and they say, oh, Professor, pretty, pretty, pretty. Can I hang it round my neck? It'll make lovely beads. Do you think they understand what I've done? They understand half of what I've done. They understand the pattern that is the reduced entropy. That is the unlikely pattern. But they've never learnt the Morse code, and so that pattern, pretty as it is, means nothing. Language is there for meaning. Remember that when you speak, that language is there very often to hide meaning. People make so many words out of a subject that is perfectly simple to express that nobody can guess, even after 40 minutes of that, what they've been talking about. Because language is there to give you meaning. And this poor boy, this poor bushman, has no idea of language convention. So in order to make a language, are you with me? in order to make a language, you've got to have a pattern on which you then hang meaning. And meaning does not arise from dicing. Meaning does not arise that way. Meaning is destroyed by chance and not made by it. So you see, to make the genetic code, you need in the first place to make the structure. And the structure of the genetic code, for those here who have done the homework, is dependent upon optical activity and asymmetry. And stochastic chemistry can't make that. The second thing that you need to make the genetic code is a language convention by which you can hang meaning onto a pattern. And if you don't have in matter language conventions, then you can't do it. And I'll guarantee this to you, ladies and gentlemen, you cannot get out of non-teleonomic matter language conventions. And the genetic code is a language convention. It can't be done. Think that out very carefully. And the creationist position on that, that you've got to have meaning react on matter to produce life, becomes perfectly clear. Now I'm going to do that and close because it's nearly 9 o'clock. There was some time ago in Chicago, when I was professor there, a group of young students, and they were Marxists and very nice boys. They were very, very socially active and quite decent fellows. Now, one day, when I was sitting at the bench doing a tricky operation, the tricky operations I usually did myself because I want to be quite sure of them and leave nothing to chance. I'm not a believer in chance myself. So I was sitting there with all my concentration, you know, microscope, and just before the distillation apparatus, just watching what was going on. And the door burst open, no knocking, and 5 or 6 people from my class burst into me. Well, I was used to that in Chicago. You know they do that. They don't learn to knock at doors or anything like that. So I said, gentlemen, what's the reception committee for? So the first one had a big red rug under his arm, a Turkish rug. So I addressed him. He said, well, sir, we've come to murder you. Oh, I said, well, no, that's Chicago is rather a serious matter, you know. I've got a wife and 4 kids. What do you want to do that for? So they said, well, we're very fond of you, you know, and you're our professor and all that, but we'll have to murder you intellectually. Oh, I said, intellectually, yes. Well, come along then. Let's have some tea. So we sat down at the table, and I asked them what it was all about. Well, they said, you do pray to God, don't you? Oh, I said, you've noticed that, have you? Oh, yes. We know all about you. So I said, yes, I'm sure I know all about you too, if you did but know. A little bit of banter, you know, just to get the ice melted after that. So they came in, sat down, and said, you know what Saul Spiegelman's done, don't you? Oh, yes, I said, I'm aware what he's done. About the virus, you mean? Yes, about the virus. Well, you say that God made the world, don't you? So I said, yes. Why? I don't see the connection. Oh, they said, if God made the world, then we've proved that Saul Spiegelman is God, because he's just made life. Oh, I said, you're thinking like that. Oh, yes, I understand you. Saul Spiegelman has done God's work. Well, they said, if you put it that way, yes. He certainly made a simple virus, which replicates, and I suppose you'd accept that as proof that you've got something that's on the borderline of life. Well, I said, yes. I would take self-replication as something. I'd like rather a metabolic apparatus so it doesn't have to live on a host organism, but I'll accept that. Well, they said, in that case, we need that Turkish rug. You better get down and pray, because we're going to finish you now. Because God didn't do it, because Saul Spiegelman did. Well, I said, I don't really see your connection there, but just explain yourself. Well, they said, you say that in the beginning, God took matter and breathed the breath of life on it, and, or the logos as you call it, and out came Adam and the other forms of life. I said, yes, more or less. Well, he said, you know, if man can do it, God doesn't need to do it. Does he? If man can do it, God doesn't need to. So I said, well, okay, if you want to accept that one, but would you tell me just how Saul Spiegelman did it? Give me the biochemical details so that we make this a productive little meeting on biochemistry. So they said, well, sir, we didn't quite follow all that has happened, but in general it was this, that he took the virus apart into its various constituent parts. Then he proceeded with very, very great care to stick those parts together again. He blocked the 8 valences that were wrong and left the one that was right open. Then on the next bit, he blocked the valences that were wrong and left the right one open and stuck them together. And so he did it with all 8 or 9 pieces that he had. And after 2 years' hard work, he produced his virus. Well, I said, isn't that just wonderful? What do you believe about it then? How do you think life came to pass? Oh, they said it happened spontaneously by chemistry, and Saul Spiegelman put the chemistry right and life came out. And I said, you think a little bit more carefully, gentlemen. Don't you think that if life took place by matter being fed energy and then being fed time, if that equals life, don't you think that Saul Spiegelman ought to have worked in a rather different way? So he said, why? So I said, well, don't you think it'd been better if he'd taken his parts of his virus and put them in a wearing blender and turned up to 20,000 revs a minute? He'd have put in an enormous amount of energy and movement, and at the same time a bit of temperature as well. And if he left it on for 5 minutes, you know, with all those collisions taking place in the bearing blender, he ought to have got his life out. Oh, but you, they said, sir, Saul Spiegelman wouldn't do a thing like that, and neither would you. So they said, well, what do you mean? And I said, this, that Saul Spiegelman certainly didn't do it by your method, but he did it by the creationist method. Now, come along, they said, creationist method, we don't want to talk about that in the lab. I said, but he did. What he did was he took his 8 parts, whatever they were, of the virus, and he added energy to it. Oh, yes, he did that. And then he added time, he let them react. But then he added, most concentrated of all, he added expertise, biochemical expertise, or biochemical concept, if you like. And because he's has such good concepts of biochemistry, knows his stuff, he applied that expertise to stick them together right, and the result was that he got his life out. Now, I said, I'd suggest to you that the first formula that you evolutionists use is this. You ready? Matter plus time plus energy equals life. The answer is, does it? And the answer to that is no. Every sardine can proves that. So they said, oh sir, that won't do, because you see, a sardine can is a closed system. They always start on that when they're lost. The sardine can is a closed system. But I said, sirs, it isn't a closed system, because you can heat a sardine can up. And if the sardine can was a glass, because you can conserve just as well in glass as you can in metal, if it's glass, it'll let in not only light, not only heat, but light as well. So you can cool and heat, and it's a totally open system. And glass is, even if possible, more open from a thermodynamic point of view. So I said, if you just have an open system, and matter plus time added to it, in the billions of cases that we've made sardine cans or any other can, we've never seen the slightest sign experimentally of any organization up to life taking place. That is spontaneous generation, have we? Why do you disregard billions of experiments? Oh, they said, sir, that's all negative evidence. You needn't talk like that to us. Well, I said, negative evidence? You want some positive evidence then too? So they said, yes, indeed we do. Well, I said, okay, keep your sardine can or your glass of meat just as it is an open system that you can feed energy into or take energy out, so it's an open thermodynamic system. And then, with very careful technical methods, you introduce one spore of blood into it. That is one concept written down in the genetic code which we can read, and which gives the ideas, the concepts necessary to build the new organism of which the spore is a representative. What will happen then? Oh, they said it will burst into life. So I said, how often will it do that? Oh, they said, regularly, as often as you do it. So I said, here we've got an experimental method. Now you take my formula for life, and I don't think I'll need to go down on your prayer mat before we finish. I said, look, every time you do this experiment, putting in one spore into a thermodynamically open system, every time you do it, you'll get the life, the system giving life. You see, the real formula for life is matter plus energy plus time plus concept. And the concept is stored on the spore. Nothing else. It's just there. The DNA molecule's there. And that holds the concept. Oh, they said, we don't like the idea of spores. We see what you mean, sir. But concept for us is something abstract. I say, hold it a minute. We'll do it that way, if you like, just to prove it. Now, take now our sardine can, and we'll keep it just the same as it was, but instead of putting in the idea crystallized on a spore, crystallized is the wrong word, but stored on a spore in a retrieval and storage system, instead of doing that, we take the concept which Sol Spiegelman read, and instead of putting it on a spore, we put it directly into that can of sardines. The idea, chemically. So instead of putting in the writing, we put in the abstract concept of the virus that Sol Spiegelman wants to get at. What then? Oh, they said, yes, we see that. The genetic code is really a physical way of storing an abstract concept, isn't it? So I said, exactly. Which is experimental? Formula number one, the evolutionary formula, which you Marxists believe in, that matter plus time plus energy equals life, or matter plus energy plus time plus concept, either stored in the form of a spore or directly abstract in the form of a biochemist getting to work at it, equals life. What would you say? And they said, sir, you got a point there. And they rushed off down to the dean after hastily slinging down their tea and asked him if they couldn't have a six-month seminar course on biogenesis if I was the professor who'd do it. And I saw the dean last week. He's 81 years old, dear old man, and he remembers all these things. And although he isn't a loud Christian, he's a very good, thoughtful old man. I'm very grateful for him. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what I've tried to show you is this, that you cannot get on to the idea of getting out life without the idea of concept, which is logos. When the Bible says, in the beginning was the logos, and the logos was with God, and God was the Logos, then I know why dear people like Noam Chomsky say that the origin of concept and word and thesis and information is something that my mind can't face up to. Because God is the Logos, and I believe that God, Jesus Christ, became conceivable for us in that he became man. If he'd remained the eternal Logos, outside time and space, my mind, which is temporal, couldn't understand him. That's why all religions add up to such nonsense. Unless they have a God who becomes God's son in flesh and blood on the same wavelength as us. So I believe that God's concept, God's mind, was represented in Jesus. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And throughout the years, I've tried to do that. I did say, you know, that I do a word on theistic evolution. Do you think I ought or do you think I ought not to? It's a bit late, isn't it? Does that mean yes or no? Oh. Sorry, difficulty in understanding the language. We've got the language concept right. Well, look, I can do it very easily. It won't take more than 5 minutes. If God made life by the principle of evolution, Darwinian evolution, then he, the all-wise one, put his wisdom in his pocket and worked by chance. Now, can you imagine an intelligent person putting his intelligence away and willingly working by non-intelligence? The scripture is universal in that it says that he made the world by wisdom, and wisdom is the cutting out of chance. So that's the first thing. The second thing is this, that theistic evolution says that the world of biology was made by God using natural selection to cut out the weak and allow the strong, which can reproduce itself, to proliferate. Okay? That is, that God destroyed, if he worked by evolution, destroyed the weak and the unadapted so that the race should become stronger and evolve upwards. Now, if Jesus was the creator, which he said he was, and he proved he was the creator by raising Lazarus 4 days after he was dead. Only the maker could do that, you know. No doctor on earth could do that. If he did it by that method, you think what that means. Because Jesus didn't kill off the blind and the halt and the lame. What did he do with them? He healed them. Darwin says he killed them. Jesus says he'll heal them and make them whole a bit more. So the principles are 180 degrees apart. Now, you think further of what Jesus said about the value of the individual. Christ died for you, the individual. Darwin says the individual may have to die for the good of the race. What Jesus does, if an individual is weak, he's promised to heal him. And what's more, he's told all his children to go out and preach the gospel and heal the sick. Now, I'm going to tell you this story, and that will be enough for this. You remember a man called Eichmann? He was Hitler's hangman. And he killed, gassed, over 5 million Jews, directly or indirectly, and he was responsible for having the mentally retarded children which my father-in-law had under his care in an institute for training deacons, training them in mental care and in medical care. My father-in-law had them there. Many, many hundreds of retarded children, mentally retarded and physically retarded. Now, Hitler said that those people were only eating up food and would never do anything useful, and it would be helping on the cause of the race to wipe these unfitted people out. So my wife was attached to a number of them, you know, and many of these mentally retarded kids had come to the Lord. And although they don't understand much, they usually understand the gospel very, very well. I saw some just recently in East Germany, completely handicapped mentally, but yet quite gloriously happy in their salvation in Christ. There's a bishop there that I've known for 30 years, a believing bishop, a man who loves the Lord, who looks after them. Now, those kids were all gassed by Hitler's henchmen, and Eichmann was behind it. Now, he fled to South America after the war and got away. But the Jews sent in, and they spirited him away, captured him, and took him back to Palestine, to Israel. And when they got him there, they found him guilty and hanged him. Now, before he was hanged, the British sent over a believing man of God, a chaplain, to talk to this poor fellow. And this poor fellow, just before he was hanged, had a last consultation with the chaplain. And the chaplain said to him, "Herr Eichmann, wouldn't you like, before you see God tomorrow, wouldn't you like..." "Oh, he's going to be hanged on the next day. This is no joke, let me tell you. Wouldn't you like to get absolution? Wouldn't you like to confess? I mean, this is no joke. Wouldn't you like to confess?" And he reared up and he said, "What have I got to confess? I've done nothing wrong." He says, "You've done nothing wrong. Do I understand you?" "Yes," he said, "I've done only right." So he said, "Would you explain yourself?" He said, "Certainly I will. Both the churches in Germany, the Catholic and the Protestant, both believed in theistic evolution. Both of them believed that God's method of creation was to wipe out the handicapped, wipe out the less fitted, and as the Jews are less fitted than other people, we believe them to be missing links. We honestly believe them to be that. I've only helped God on in his methods. I've only catalyzed God's way of working. And when I meet God, I shall tell him so. He works by that method." Now you think, a Catholic church and a Protestant church teaching that, and you think how many do it here and don't realize what they're doing. If God worked by that way, that method, then Jesus ought never to have preached the Sermon on the Mount, because Jesus is the Creator. All things were made by him and for him and for his glory and enjoyment. Now, if he made the world by the process of eliminating the handicapped and the sick, then he ought never to have said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Okay? Are we all right? You see, everything which is Christian, everything which is really the mind of Christ, has been cut out if you say that it was done by the mechanism of neo-Darwinian theory. That is, by chance, mutation, natural selection, sorting out the unfitted from the fit in order that the race may rise. In the first place, you can't do it that way. In the second place, all that natural selection does do is keep the species constant, as I pointed out in my two books. So be very, very careful of this. And if you are asked, as I was asked today on the radio in this interview, do you believe creationism to be scientific? I say yes, because it's the method by which all scientists work. They all apply their expertise, their concept, to matter, and get the same results as God did, in a little way. But I had to say to one of these people who very much provoked me on this question, I said, "You know, what we're doing is plagiarizing God. We're observing science, and we can see how God did it, and then we copy it from him." Now, I've had people plagiarize my books. And do you know what they always do, plagiarists? Copycats, we call them, don't we? Do you know what they always do? They always deny the existence of the real author. Right or wrong? Now, I think, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, that will be enough for tonight, because I'm sure there will be some questions. Thank you for being so very quiet and helpful to me tonight. Thank you.
right. At this time, we'll let Dr. Wilder Smith come again and tackle some of these questions that have been sent up to the front.
Okay. Yes, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. First question is, please explain carefully in big black letters and slowly in big black letters so that I can understand what your word teleonomy means. Also, in what dictionary or encyclopedia I can find this word. Well, teleonomy is the word which was used by Jacques Monod in his book Chance and Necessity, and it means the possession of telos. And telos is the possession of aim or project. Now, if a bird builds a nest, that's a project, and the bird is said to be teleonomic. If a man writes a book to communicate information, that is teleonomic, because he has the idea of transmitting information. It's a useful word to use. It was invented by Jacques Monod. Telos, aim, logos, thesis, both related. If all things were created by God at the same time, can the Archaeopteryx, okay, the spelling's reasonable, bird be any younger or older than the other birds? Now, that's a good question. I personally said very carefully that the geologists working by geological methods had shown it in the column which they recognize to be geologically younger than the modern birds. Now, I'm catching them on their own hook. I do believe that God did make the creatures in eternity as he made us. Before any of our members were, he saw them. And he made the days before I was born to exist for me in today. But then he put the creation, which was completed in his eternal thoughts on 6 separate days, into time and space. He put Adam in on the 6th day with some of the animals. The idea that people can't grasp today is due to a lack of teaching in the schools on what dimension theory is. If they were to give you a course on dimension theory of even 1 semester, you wouldn't have any trouble. But for the last 50 years, one has not done it. And the result is people are at sea when they hear of God making things in the eternal dimensions and then putting them into time. Because eternity is not time, and time is not eternity. Time is a construction of eternity, and you can put it in eternity into time on 1 day. An example is Jesus, the eternal Son of God, begotten before time began, slain before the foundation of the earth, who saw me before I was existed or one of my members was formed. It says in the scriptures, and historically we know it to be the case, the Eternal One came into time on Christmas Day. That is, eternity entered time on 25th of December, if it was that date, 1981 years ago. So the idea of an eternity entering time on 1 day should be understandable on the basis of Christ, the Eternal One, entering time on 1 day. And I believe you're quite right about Archaeopteryx. I believe that all the creation was produced, as the Ten Commandments says, for in 6 days God made heaven and earth and all that in them is. Now, if that's in the Ten Commandments and is not true, then why should I respect the other commandments? You remember the story of the little boy who went into a British public school, which you as a private school, don't you? When a little boy goes into a public school in England, it's a boarding school, he's taken to the chief prefect. At least he was when I was at school. And the chief prefect has to introduce him. So he takes him
the headmaster's study, the most feared room in all the school. And this little boy was taken to the door of the headmaster's study, and there in golden letters were written on the door the Ten Commandments of the school. And the first commandment was, I am Dr. Top Man. There are no other authorities in this school outside Dr. Top Man. Commandment number one. Commandment number two was, thou shalt not make any caricatures of Dr. Top Man. The third was, likewise, thou shalt not take the name of Dr. Top Man in vain. And the fourth one was this. Listen, fourth one was this. I say this about the 6 days. Fourth one was this. Lights out at 9 o'clock. There is to be no reading under the bedclothes with a flash lamp after 9 o'clock, because the man in the moon might see this and be deeply grieved at such lack of discipline in our public school here. Now, when the boy read that, he said, have I got to believe that? So the head prefect said, you sure have? And pulled his ear. You see, they do worse things than that sometimes. Pulled his ear in this case. And the boy said, but I can't. If Dr. Topman believes there's a man in the moon who can see me reading under the bedclothes with a lamp at night, if Dr. Topman believes that, he's not fit to be head of school. With that, he was kicked out. Now, you see, if we take the sixth commandment that we should keep the Sabbath day holy, for on the seventh God rested from all the works he did, if we say then that the conclusion that in 6 days God made heaven and earth as comes in the sixth commandment, if we say that, then we say, Dr. Top Man, God, made a mistake. And then the little commandment about adultery, you know, falls also. The little commandment about sexual cleanliness falls also. The little commandment about not bearing false witness and not stealing falls also. If you have one phony commandment, the rest are phony. Now, if those 6 days, such as I've explained them, are phony, then the rest of the commandments are phony too. Who's going to make the distinction? Now, I believe that it's perfectly easy to understand if schools were doing their jobs. And they're not. They're not teaching them dimension theory. And if they did teach them dimension theory, you'd have no difficulty in understanding that time could be put into eternity through an event horizon, and vice versa. That eternity could enter time on one day through an event horizon. Nobody knows today what an event horizon is. Not taught that in school. It's a complete fall down of your total education system. Europe's just as bad. And it's a result of the total materialism into which we've fallen. The total humanism into which we've fallen. And it's time Christians took these matters into their own hands and started their own schools. It's the only way of doing it. Leave that. Let's get on to this one. We have a copy of the Los Angeles Times, which has an article on the latest find of the evolutionists, Ramapithecus. Oh, yes, in China. Have you seen it? I saw some long time ago things about Ramapithecus, but I'd rather given up interest in it. Have you seen it, and do you care to address this claim? Well, I believe myself that the spectrum of species at the beginning, that is the spectrum from, say, virus up to the amoeba, from the amoeba up to the other animals and up to man, I believe that it was much fuller than it is today. You see, even today, animals are dying out rapidly. The spectrum is getting thinner. You take the whooping cranes, if something isn't done, they'll die. You take the whales, they'll die. The great whales, you know, unless something is done. So the species are getting thinner. But I believe there were animals which biologically may lie between the apes and man. I don't think they could have spoken or anything like that, but I see no reason for the denial of the existence of beings of whom we have skeletons or fossil remains. The thing that's at risk is how we interpret them. Now, I interpret them that way, that God made a much fuller spectrum, and that the second law of thermodynamics, which started at the law of the fall of Adam, is wiping out the species, and we're in danger ourselves. And we shall do it ourselves if we go on being so schizophrenic as we are, destroy ourselves. If we don't do it by sex and promiscuity in sex, we'll do it by other means. We're well on the way by breaking the commandments of God to doing it. Now, that won't prove evolution. All it'll prove is devolution. Evolution downhill, nothing else. Oh, yes. How did we get other colors? I don't know what that really means. I will think about that one. Darwin's statement that man evolved out of a deep, darkest Africa, along with the my reading ability is failing. Evolved. Would anybody like to help me on this? Perhaps you can understand the local language convention, which I don't. With these, who discovered lots of bodies, fragments, etc. Since Egypt, the most northern part and east near Israel, can it be they are bones of our ancestors? Please explain to our brothers and sisters about anthropology. Yes, that's right. Well, you know, I'm genuine. I do my best, you know. I try harder, as they say here. Please, next time you come to Costa Mesa, yes, Costa Mesa, please talk in a language that your children can understand. My children do, so. I fear gastric chemistry is too much for a 7-year-old. Yes, what it may be. But you see, you can never talk so that all will understand you. Never. Karl Popper said that, and that's one of the true things he said in his life. What you do... I didn't mean that nastily either. Didn't Richard Leakey discover some years ago very old bones which refuted the missing link theory? He sure did. He threw overboard the whole structure of the family tree, which had been put up by anthropologists before him. But he set up his own then. But they all believe, Leakey and the others, that one creature, because the gross morphology is similar, evolved out of the other. And that's the basic error. I don't think that can be. And I've given you my reasons tonight. Why not? So, missing links are, for me, not missing. Now, oh yes, we've got an old hoary one here. When a horse is crossed with an ass, a mule or a jack, is produced. Okay, no doubts, quite right. All depends which way around you do it. And therefore, if a human is crossed with an ape, which you can't do, of course, through artificial insemination, of course, could
this lead to a possible result? Well, unfortunately, it's been tried and tried many times, and the chromosomes of an ape just don't pair up with those of a man, and you don't get any result at all. Now, a horse and an ass are, of course, quite similar, and the chromosomes do pair, but the mule which comes out is nearly always totally sterile. There are cases where they can breed a bit, but they're very, very rare. It's because the chromosome pairs do match, and you can't do it unless you get a holistic program, half of which will match to the other half of the holistic program, that you get a result coming out like that. So I don't think that you can do that, because some apes have more chromosomes than we do. Is it true that seawater is a common element to all life? Oh, well, you can have sodium chloride in life, and you can have sodium chloride in the sea. As far as that goes, it's okay. And is also present as a fluid in the embryonic sac. Of course it is, otherwise you wouldn't get the osmotic pressure right in the human embryo. So therefore, they say, the human being evolved from a sea animal. That's what we're getting at, isn't it? Now, you know, you mustn't reason like that. It's very dangerous to do that. You have that done on a wide scale today, and I very much deprecate it. You take this. If you find a substance, say a protein, in a man, which is very like a protein in an ape, and less like a protein in a pig, and less like the same homologous sort of a protein in, say, a mole or a frog, they say, well, that gives you the evolutionary tree, this. It looks very nice, but in actual fact, it's quite ridiculous, because, though I'm going to give you the reason. The reason is this, that if you take my blood, you can find the hemoglobin in it. Now, where you find hemoglobin which is similar to that in a man, say like in a pig, you say that there's some embryonic connection, evolutionary connection. Now, take that to the extreme. If you go into your garden and dig up the legumes, the peas, in the garden, you'll find in the root nodules, you'll find in the roots little nodules. And those are the nodules that fix the nitrogen, so that leguminous plants enrich the soil with nitrogen. Every farmer knows that. Every biologist knows that. Now, if you cut those nodules through, you'll find hemoglobin in them. Therefore, I am related to a pea nodule. No, I don't mean that to be funny, you know, at all. It's just the way people think. Now, you mustn't laugh at other people when they think that way. It's a very serious matter indeed. Let me take it one thing further. If you have some time to discipline your child, I'm against brutality in disciplining children, but I do believe you must discipline them. I was disciplined myself, and sure, made me less bad than I'd otherwise have been, you see. Now, if you whip them, you will, on the rearward portions, get a wheal. And the wheal is due to the liberation of histamine, which we all have in our body. Now, if you go in the garden and catch hold of a stinging nettle, you will find the histamine in it. Therefore, you're related to a stinging nettle, whichever way you care to look at these things. They're quite specific substances, you know. You shouldn't think like that. It's a question of the program in the genetic code, which is really important. What you should ask is, where did the specific information come from for histamine in a man, or for hemoglobin in a man, and for histamine in a stinging nettle, or for hemoglobin in a pea plant? And if you can say the concepts are similar, the chemical concepts, then of course we're on sure ground. It's out of a program. And only a person who is intelligent makes a program takes the program as a basis for his whole life. Be careful to think of these things. Why is there evolution? Because there are programs. That's why evolution is. And if you say evolution is because there are no programs, and natural selection and chance produce the programs, or what look like programs, I can't agree, because programs always come from concepts. The virus which causes canine parvovirus disease of dogs has only existed for the past two or three years. Well, we found it in the last two or three years, sure. I don't know about the rest, maybe. But it is so similar to the virus which causes feline panleukopenia, a similar disease of cats, that immunizing dogs with panleukopenia vaccine designed to protect cats will produce immunity to parvovirus. Just, I think that'll be all right. Two substances are similar, so that'll be all right. The current theory thus far has been to presume that parvovirus is a mutant form of panleukopenia. Okay, I wouldn't object to that at all. You see, if you take a program and shoot at it once, you may produce a variant. But if you shoot at it a lot, you won't get it to vary upwards into a higher form, but you will reduce it to informational noise. That's all. It's perfectly okay. Evolutionists cite this as evidence of evolution of viruses. What do you say? I say it's evolution, that if you modify a program by chance, you'll modify it, that's all. Biologists and geologists define a species as being reproductively isolated. Yes, a pool of interbreeding genes is the correct definition. On a very small level, the idea of evolution starts with this idea that a particular kind of animal can through various means become separated or unable to reproduce with its original kind. Okay, no difficulty, and therefore are defined as a separate species. Well, you can do it that way, but I mean, if you say breed poodles from wolves and from dogs, and you breed St. Bernards, you know, these huge Swiss dogs up in the mountains, or the Newfoundland dogs, if you breed them, they're physically incapable of copulation, of course. The size prevents it, for one thing. But if you overcome that difficulty, you will get hybrids out, because they've both got the same type of genetic storage, information retrieval and storage systems. I mean, they fit together, the pairs. They are the dog kind. And they'll always recognize one as a dog. The smallest Pekingese will recognize as a dog the biggest St. Bernard. So there's no difficulty about that, but you haven't produced evolution by producing a huge St. Bernard. If you breed horses in one man's lifetime, you can get out an animal, it's been done in Argentina, an animal the size of a dog that you can put under your arm, and one that's too big to climb up to on a pair of step ladders. Yeah. But they're both horses and recognize one another as such. It's the idea of the conception of what the genetic code is that is at fault here. It's a holistic audio tape or videotape information storage or retrieval system. If you think of it as that, you'll know what it'll do roughly. Changing the DNA helix through point mutations can only create lower forms of life. Is this true? Please elaborate. Well, I don't know about that. If you mean the synthesis of DNA, you can't get the DNA helix out, such as we need it for life, from racemic products. It doesn't form the spirals. And if it does form very, very short spirals, as it may do under certain circumstances, the spirals are devoid of any information. They're like the page of a book on which nothing is written. The problem is to get A, the structure, and optical activity is needed for that, and B, the language that fits on it. Where you're going to get the language formed by chemical means, I don't know. It beats me, unless you have a god, a concept, to do it with. What about symmetry in randomly formed crystal? Well, a randomly formed crystal, of course, isn't randomly formed. That's all. Because the stochastic formation of a crystal is guided by the angles of the valences. Now, if you guide chance, it isn't chance. So how you can say a crystal is formed randomly, I don't know, because it isn't. It's guided on the
endogenous information residing on the ions or the particles of which the crystals made. So think about that very carefully. I'm surprised, you know, they don't do these things when you're 11 years old at school. We did then, you know. They don't today. You get a man starting to read his medicine when he's too old to learn anything. He's got four kids and he's 30 years old. And the consequence is he has great difficulty in learning anything, like I do at my age. Doesn't one crystal lattice start another from only one molecule? Sure it does. Sure it does. But then it uses the information which is on the molecules to build the regular type of crystal. And if you want, if a substance is capable of forming two types of crystals, you only have to put a seed in of one type and it'll form all one, or you put a seed in of the other type and it'll form all the other. I've often been foxed on that myself, because sometimes when you produce a new substance, you get lovely plates of crystals. And then you do it again and you get a mass of needles. Now that's due to the starting of the crystals by bits of dust which get into the solution, which have various shapes. And the shape that gets in first produces the crystal. But on the basis of the information on the atoms or the ions. It is my understanding that the computers associated with NASA discovered a lost day when backing the computers through time. That's correct. Do you think that this is the long day of Joshua and the day of Hezekiah? Oh, I'd say the possibilities are certainly there, because computers are very accurate and you can calculate how much time has been lost. So I regarded that find as quite a useful thing. I'm not able to check it myself because I'm not that up in the use of these NASA computers. Now, that's all the information there, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very, very much. Very kind of you, and I wish you God bless.